This whole thing started when I was only 4 years old. Some relatives came to visit us in Meriden, Connecticut, where we lived. My older brother, Joseph Jr., who was nicknamed Buddy, was the firstborn, so he was Superchild, the heir apparent. I, 4 years younger, was the mistake. My brother was asked, "Buddy, do you know what you want to be when you grow up?" "I want to be Dick Tracy, Joe Palooka, and Buck Rogers," Buddy answered. "Great," I thought. "He wants to be a comic strip." Even though no one asked me, I announced, "When I grow up, I am going to be an artist. I'm going to write stories and draw pictures for books, and I'm going to sing and tap dance on the stage." You see, I had twin cousins who were in art school. They were very glamorous. My mother read to me every night, and I loved books, and I was a huge fan of Shirley Temple movies. Every chance I got over the next few years, I would tell the grown-ups around me what the future held for me, and they all took me seriously. Mrs. Beulah Bowers, the art teacher, who came to our school periodically, made sure I got extra pieces of paper and could use my own crayons. Miss Leah Grossman, my tap dancing teacher, gave me special roles in the annual recital, so in my heart I could rival Shirley Temple. And then, when I was older and paired with Carol Morrissey, my dancing partner, we were Meriden's answer to Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. My grandfather was a butcher and owned a grocery store. His response was to give me a small roll of white butcher paper and a Listo pencil it can write on anything, so I could draw to my heart's content and not on the sheets under the covers of my bed. My parents, Flossie and Joe, and Uncle Charles were the best. Uncle Charles asked me one time when we were alone, "So you really want to be an artist?" I answered, "Yes." He grabbed the Sunday comics that were still lying around and said, "Can you copy the Cats and Jammer kids?" "Uncle Charles," I answered, "Franny and Fuffy," my Irish twin cousins who were artists and had recently graduated from Pratt Institute, "told me to practice, 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 and never copy. Ask me to draw something else, and I will." After I finished my drawing, Uncle Charles took it into the kitchen, and I could hear him talking to my mother. "He's good. We have to do something about this," he said. Segway to Christmas morning, 1945, when I was 11. Because I had two younger sisters, Santa Claus still came to our house, so the best presents were under the tree Christmas morning. I remember it so clearly. There under the tree were my gifts, all art supplies, books on how to draw, paints, pads, and even an easel. I was set to go. First, let me back up a little. Mrs. Cowing, the library lady, came every Friday morning to King Street School. The third through sixth grades would go to the library room on the second floor, where they could check out two or three books for a week. I first noticed Mrs. Cowing in first grade. I'd see her park her old jalopy in front of school, call some older boys to help her unload boxes of books, and bring them to the library room. I found out that certain kids would be chosen to be library monitors, and they would help Mrs. Cowing set out the books. And sometimes Mrs. Cowing would bring special books just for the monitors. I had a goal. I would become a library monitor. I had almost 2 years to work on this. Nothing works quite as well as charm, and I had plenty of that. I'd stand so she could see me when she drove up. I'd smile and say, "Hello, library lady." She'd wave back. One day, she came over to me smiling. "Little boy," she whispered, "it's pronounced library." "Hello, library lady," I said the next week. She blew me a kiss. By the time I got into second grade, even though I couldn't be a monitor, I could help carry in books. I could bend her ear a little about how much I loved books. In September came as no surprise when Miss Bailey, my third grade teacher, read out that I would be a library monitor. On Friday morning, I would meet the jalopy, carry boxes of books up to the library room, set books out on tables, all the time taking a peek inside the covers. Because I was a monitor, I would be there all morning. I got to peek at fourth grade books, fifth grade books, and sixth grade books. What glorious Fridays! For the next 3 years, I'd hang around and talk with Mrs. Cowling. She put into my hands Hitty, Her First 100 Years, by Rachel Field, illustrations by Dorothy Lathrop, Make Way for Ducklings and Homer Price, by Robert McCloskey, and the beautiful books by the Dallaires. She pointed out the books that had won Newbery and Caldecott medals. What riches Mrs. Cowling gave me! Junior high was everything I had hoped for. We had art 3 times a week with Miss Goldman. She taught painting techniques, puppetry, jewelry making, all sorts of things. And any time a student wanted to spend time after school doing art, Miss Goldman welcomed us with open arms. Miss Cole, the school librarian, was always happy to recommend just the right books. She encouraged me to read everything from Lewis Carroll, Robert Louis Stevenson, Alcott, Dickens, the Brontes, to Armstrong Sperry, and yes, Gone with the Wind. She introduced me to the illustrations of Rackham, Tenniel, Doyle, Kai Nielsen, Edward Kemble, and countless others, and I could check out all the books I wanted. In 8th grade, we had a class called Guidance. We had to write a biography of someone in the profession we might aspire to. I chose Grant Wood. I even stated that I wanted to attend Pratt Institute. High school was easy. I was really good in English, history, social studies, music. I hadn't lost any of my singing and dancing abilities, art, of course, and French. Dr. Michel, my French teacher, introduced me to the works of the Impressionists, Picasso, Matisse, and many others. I was awarded an important scholarship from the city of Meriden. Pratt was a certainty. I was the best artist in my high school, but at Pratt Institute in 1952, I was suddenly in a freshman class with 500 other best artists in their high schools. Only 125 would make it to sophomore year. Miraculously, I made it. My idols went from Norman Rockwell and John Whitcomb, known for his pretty girl illustrations, to Rouault, Matisse, Modigliani, and Ben Shahn. I so admired the illustration work of Alison Martin Provenson, Sheila Beckett, Rodzinkowski, Leone, and of course this new guy who put little boys in ballet slippers in his illustrations for Ruth Krauss's You Be Me, Maurice Sondheim or Steinbeck, you know who I mean. I wouldn't have had the success that I did at Pratt if it wasn't for my painting instructors, Roger Crossgrove and Federico Castellan. Richard Lindner and Enrico Arno taught illustration. In 1955, I received a scholarship to the Skowhegan Summer School of Painting and Sculpture. It was there that I met and was chosen to spend every morning for 2 weeks with the mentor of all time, Ben Shahn. He said to me the words that have meant the most to me. Being an artist is not only what you do, but how you live your life. Then I took a brief detour. I was now an artist, but instead of becoming a children's book illustrator as well as a painter, I decided to become a monk, a Benedictine monk, a Benedictine artist monk. And so after graduation from Pratt, I entered a small, very primitive Benedictine monastery in the Green Mountains of Vermont. Needless to say, I didn't stay. The silence got to me. So with the blessings of the prior, I left to be just an artist. That was 1957. Yearly, I would take the bus from Vermont to New York to show my portfolio to publishers. The editors, most of them, were really nice. I was told over and over, if you ever move back to New York. I spent the years painting, designing Christmas cards, and doing set design for the summer theater in the small town I lived in. I started doing church murals. I moved to Boston, had 2 one-man shows, and began teaching art in a women's college outside of the city. But I still dreamed of becoming a published children's book illustrator. I was almost resigned to the fact that I'd have to be content with being the artist I had become. I had a good following in the gallery I showed in. I was getting good commissions, too. And I was producing a modestly successful card line. In 1963, I moved back to New York. Then a miracle happened. I met Florence Alexander. She was an artist representative. When I brought her my portfolio, she said after looking at the hot pink and orange tigers and other creative stuff, "Dear, I'll need some more samples. Samples of children waving at fire trucks, mothers ironing, you know, ordinary things." I wanted to draw foreign-looking little boys wearing ballet slippers, like Maurice Sendak did. I said I'd work on it and get back to her. I figured 3 weeks would be long enough, and then I'd call her and pick up my portfolio. It didn't work that way. Florence called me before I had a chance to call her. "Hello, dear," she said. "Hi-ho, hi-ho. I think it's off to work we go. Can you be at my office tomorrow around 10? "Of course," I answered. "Good," she replied. "And by the way, do you have those new samples ready?" I muttered some false excuse. The next morning at the office, I met the person who gave me my big break. Her name was Bernice Cohn, now Hunt. She was starting a new list of science picture books for Coward McCann. She was doing the writing, and there would be 2 books each list, 4 in a year. She wanted an established illustrator for one, and a newcomer for the other. I was possibly going to be the newbie. I was asked to do a couple of samples. During the process, Bernice became a dear, dear friend. So did Florence, and also the in-house editor at Coward McCann, Margaret Frith. I worked with Margaret at Coward and eventually at Putnam for 40-some years. Well, it all began. I got the job. But there was a hitch. I also had a job for 10 weeks in Provincetown for, you guessed it, a musical review in which I would sing and dance on the stage. Okay, the deadline would work. I had to produce the dummy, the sketch form with words in place. No problem. I had until September. So there I was in Provincetown, dancing and singing at night and working on the illustrations for my first book, Sound, during the day. I heard 4-year-old Tommy saying, "When I grow up, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to write stories and draw pictures for books and sing and dance on the stage." Suddenly, this was my life. Sound was reviewed in the New York Times Book Review when it was published 1.5 years later. Good facts, but the illustrations by first-time illustrator DePaola are far too imaginative for a science book. Far too imaginative. I was thrilled. And so was Bernice. Florence was energized, and the jobs started rolling in. The next was from Jean Vestal at Lippincott. Don't worry, I'm not going through all 250 titles. But I am going to mention some of the people who guided me through this complicated, fickle, dangerous, and exalting field of children's books. Mary Russell at Bob's Merrill taught me to write with martinis. Eunice Holsart told me I had stories to tell. Ellen Roberts and Sue Jennings helped me give birth to Strega Nona. Barbara Lucas published Nana Upstairs and Nana Downstairs at Putnam, and then The Clown of God at Harcourt. Marjorie Kyler let me explore my Catholic childhood. John and Kate Briggs of Holiday House not only published my books, but partied with me too. Maria Madunio was like my much younger little sister when I first met her. There were others too, all wonderful people. Nanette Stevenson was my first art director at Putnam. Cecilia Jung is my art director now and my muse. And Marika Tamara is my designer of choice. I have the best publisher in the world, Penguin Putnam. I love everyone there so much. David Shanks, Doug Whiteman, Don Weisberg, Jen Haller, Emily Romero, and Felicia Frazier, to name a few. They are all in my heart. And I have a new editor, Nancy Paulson. And even though I'm an old guy, I know I still have more books in me. I wouldn't be up here if not for all of you who have gotten my books into the hands of children over the 40-plus years that I've been doing what I do. Thank you, Millie Nichols, Carolyn Field, Augusta Baker, Pura Belpre, Effie Lee Morris, Ann Kalkoff, Carolyn Ward, June Level, Barbara Elliman, Grace Ruth, Noreen Odlin, Carolyn Brody, Elizabeth Bird, and all my other friends in ALA. A piece of this medal belongs to all of you. So you can see, with me, it didn't take a village. It took a metropolis. At the end of the movie Nine, based on the Broadway show, and the Fellini film Eight and a Half, little Guido runs down this huge set to sit on the lap of old Guido as the camera crane moves up. Filming is about to begin. This is what I do. I call little four-year-old Tommy to sit on my lap when I write and when I draw. He tells me what is true. Now, I know you all like to hear about The Call. Mine came on Sunday night, January 9th. I was having my annual holiday party, and the house was filled with over 70 people. Fortunately, I was standing by the bar waiting for a drink. The phone was right there. It rang, and I answered it through the din. The voice said, "You might want to take this call." I retreated into my bedroom, and Megan gave me the news. I was totally blown away. The Wilder Award was not on my radar. I started to cry and told the committee that their taste was impeccable. But then I was told I had to keep it a secret until the next day. I could tell my assistant, Bob Hetchel, but no one else. That was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I wanted to run back to the party and yell, "Drinks on the house!" Little Tommy joins me in saying thank you to Bob for everything you do, and especially to the committee. Megan Schleisman, Joanne Jonas, Andrew Medlar, Martha V. Paravano, and Angela J. Reynolds, who chose to honor me with this award. I am extremely humbled and totally grateful. You have given me and my work eternity.